Well, thank you for the introduction, and thank you, Your Highnesses, for inviting me to this symposium. I must congratulate whoever came up with this topic, because it was incredibly prescient whenever you were planning it 6 months ago, a year ago, because we're really at, it's always hard to tell, to judge in the moment, and maybe it's a flaw of journalists to always think that what's happening right now is incredibly important, but it does feel like a sort of turning point has been reached in the relationship between the West and the East, and in particular, as Keisha was saying, in the relationship between China and the United States. What I'll try to do, perhaps a little less elegantly and in a less structured way than Keisha, but is to put what's happening today in the news into some kind of historical perspective, and then to suggest what it might mean for the West, and perhaps to give a slightly different view from Keisha, who I think, if I'm not being unfair, really largely said this is to do with the West, with the US's inability to cope with what's happening, the rise of China, and suggest there may actually be some problems for the West generally with the rise of China, and particularly with its current authoritarian model and what that might mean for the world in general. But before I get to that point, let me go back a little bit, and I think you can see this current confrontation, which really took off in the last couple of weeks with the raise in tariffs and so on, as the culmination of, in some ways, a 40-year process. And that 40-year process was the opening of China and the way that the West responded to it. And I think for 40 years, the West has essentially welcomed the rise of China, has placed a bet on the idea that China could be safely integrated into the world system, and that this was essentially a positive development and a stabilizing development. And I think what we've seen in the last few days is the culmination of a discrediting, at least in the minds of the Americans, of that view, and a move to a sharply different process. I'll come to that, why they came to that conclusion in a little while, but I think it's also important to see it in an even broader historical perspective, and to see it really as maybe a turning point, which is the culmination of a 500-year process. Now, what do I mean by that? I think that you can say that it was at the end of the 1400s, 1497, 1498, that the era of European and Western dominance of the world really began, with the particularly the discovery by Vasco da Gama of the route to Asia, the great voyages of exploration by the Spanish and the Portuguese, which then culminated in ever-accumulating European power all over the world, the great formation of great European empires, the Spanish, the Portuguese, the Dutch, obviously, the British, French. So that by the beginning of the 20th century, European domination of the globe was pretty complete. Something like 80% of the world's territory was either a European colony or a country that was an offshoot culture of Europe, such as the United States, Australia, and so on. And European military dominance was complete, technological, way ahead. Economic dominance was huge. But then you have the First and Second World Wars, and that sort of act of European civil war, in a sense, brings to an end the period of European dominance of the world. But it doesn't bring to an end the period of Western dominance of the world, because the United States takes over as the world's most powerful country from the UK and continues to dominate, in particular in Asia. Now, of course, it's a bipolar system. You have the Soviet Union as well. But the Soviet Union is also a European power, and the fault line of world politics is through Berlin. And so, in a sense, the West, Europe, remains the center of world affairs. But in the background, something is going on by the in the post-war period, which shifts this balance of power. And that is the very, very rapid economic development of Asia. It doesn't start in China. It starts with the rebuilding of Japan. You have then the tiger economies, South Korea, Malaysia, Singapore, and so on. But it really begins to change the balance of power in the world when the process reaches China, because to have a country the size of a Singapore or even a South Korea move to rapid industrialization is one thing, but a country of over 1 billion people, when it begins to attain something even close to Western living standards, is shifting the entire balance of power of the global economy and ultimately of global politics. And so by 2014, Kishore mentioned the IMF figures. He said, well, he'd said to people, what about, aren't they suggesting that within 10 years, China might be the world's largest economy? Well, actually, in 2014, measured in one respect, in purchasing power parity, the IMF did announce that China was the world's largest economy. And in fact, three of the four largest economies in the world were now in Asia, China number one, the US number two, Japan at three, and India at four. And even in real terms, China will probably be the largest economy in the world by the mid-2020s. And there are other measures as well which show the enormous economic, growing economic power of China in real terms. China's now the world's largest manufacturer. It's the world's largest exporter. It's the world's largest market for vehicles, for smartphones. It consumes more Kentucky Fried Chicken than any other country in the world, which may be the secret American design to destroy China. But China has arrived. It's no longer a question of saying, you know, this could happen. I think something may be changing. It's happened. And you've had a shift, which I think Kishore described in slightly provocative, but I think broadly accurate terms, a shift in the American perception of what this means for them. Because he's talked about that in some detail, I'll talk about that relatively briefly and then move on to how I think China's responded. But I think it's certainly correct that there has been a shift in America's sense of what does all this mean for us. The earlier attitude was, I think, summed up probably best succinctly by George W. Bush, but it could have been one of a number of presidents saying this. Bush said, trade freely with China and time is on our side. And what he meant by that was an idea most of us will be familiar with, that if you have free trade, that China will open up to the world. If China opens up to the world, it will have to become a democratic country, because the lesson we all drew from 1989, from the fall of the Berlin Wall, was that that undemocratic systems kind of failed economically. That's what had happened with the Soviet Union. But oddly enough, something else happened in 1989, and we'll be looking back at that next week when the anniversary of Tiananmen Square happens. The Chinese had their own democracy movement in 1989, and they crushed it very brutally. But I think because that coincided with the end of the Cold War in Europe, there was a sense that the Chinese in the West, that surely the Chinese were on the wrong side of history, and that they would either have to go become democratic or they would suffer the fate of the Soviet Union there. Their model would collapse. I think if you'd said to anyone back then, and a lot of us were back then, so we'll remember, you know what, in 30 years' time, the Chinese economy will be like four times the size it is now, but there'll still be a one-party state. Everybody in the West would have said, no, that's not going to happen. But actually, that is what happened. So that by 2014, or 2016, when Trump's running for president, America is primed for a change in attitude. And Trump is probably, in his kind of strange, instinctive way, as the politician who spots that. He campaigns in very vivid, over-the-top language against China. He says China's been literally raping the United States, that China is a huge threat. He says he'll bring in tariffs. A lot of us say, oh, well, he won't really do that, obviously. But that's what he says he's going to do. And he strikes a chord, and that's very interesting, because we had had protectionist candidates running in the United States before then, people like Pat Buchanan, Tom Harkin, long-forgotten Democratic senator, but they'd always failed. And there was a sense that, you know, protectionism doesn't sell in America. America's a free trade country. But America was ready for Trump's message on China, and indeed, he followed through. So far, the story I'm telling you is similar to the one that Kishore told you, that this is a story about a superpower that made a wrong bet, that is unable to come to terms with the rise of this alternative power, and that is responding in a perhaps irrational and self-harming way to try to block China. And I agree, again, there is this ambiguity in what the Americans are doing. Is this about just getting a better trade deal? Or is it really about trying to block the rise of China? And I think even in the administration's own mind, that debate hasn't really been settled. I think there are various schools. There are people in the White House who do see this primarily as really being tough, but in the end, you make a deal, you get trade back on track, and it's just been all recalibrated. But then there's, if you like, what you could call the Steve Bannon wing, or he's no longer in the White House, but people who think like him are, who are saying, no, this is the beginning of an economic war, and this is to block the rise of China. And this is our last chance to do it, actually, because they're becoming so powerful that unless we do it now, it's over. So I think that that Bannonite school has, for the moment, is in the ascendancy. And as I say, it feels like a historic moment, but one should be cautious because Trump is a very volatile president. And, you know, in a few weeks' time, he could change his mind. If the markets tank, if he's 6 months out from the presidential election, he could decide to make a deal. And as one of his aides said to me slightly ruefully, the president gets on very well with authoritarian leaders. He was thinking of Kim Jong-un, but it could equally be Xi Jinping. So it's not impossible. But I think at the moment, it does feel like things are going towards more confrontation, particularly over economics. As I say, so far, this is a story all about the United States, its inability to respond to the rise of China, and its decision that it's got it wrong, it's shifting course. But what's going on in China? What's the Chinese end of this story? And this is where I think I diverge slightly from Kishore. Because I think that it's not just that China failed to become more democratic in the way that liberal theory in the West predicted. It's actually become more authoritarian. And not just more authoritarian domestically, it has, I think, become more assertive internationally. Both in military terms, this kind of South China Sea stuff that Kishore was discussing, but also in terms of promoting, as the EU said in its paper, an alternative model of governance. And I think that's begun to raise a question that's of relevance not just to the United States, but to the whole of the West, which is, what will the world feel like if the most powerful country in the world is not a democracy, is in fact an authoritarian one-party state? And I think that is a legitimate cause for concern, and it's something that should concern Europeans as much as Americans. And I'll explain at the end why I think that is the case. But let me briefly, as a non-Sinologist, but as somebody who's gone backwards and forwards to China, you know, several times over the years since the early 90s, describe how I think things have changed. I think Xi Jinping is a new style of Chinese leader, and in some ways a repudiation not just of his immediate predecessors, but of Deng Xiaoping, who was a great leader, the leader who really opened up China, but who also attempted to move China away from a Mao-style, not just one-party state, but one-leader state, where everything was focused around the question of the leader. He was under Deng that the idea of term limits for presidents was introduced. Those term limits were abolished by Xi. And it was Deng's successors, who seemed rather colorless in a way that I think we may now feel nostalgic for, who were kind of collective leaders. They weren't very assertive. They certainly didn't attempt to create a cult of personality. Hu Jintao was not a Mao figure by any stretch of the imagination. With Xi Jinping, you get a leader who internally launches a massive anti-corruption drive, which leads to literally, I think, well over 1 million arrests, who also begins to consolidate power around himself by abolishing term limits, establishing a National Security Council, actually on the American model, in which the president controls foreign policy, but by becoming much more active in economic policy, but also by encouraging kind of new narratives about both the role of the party and the role of himself within China internally, but also what they represent externally. And what Xi does is to capitalize and to bring to the fore the narrative of Chinese rejuvenation. The phrase that he uses a lot is the great rejuvenation of the Chinese people, which in a way is his equivalent of make America great again. He's saying make China great again. Fair enough. Everybody's at it. But the context in which he does it is interesting, The first time, or one of the first times that phrase occurs and is hammered home, is in a speech early in his period in office when he goes to the National History Museum in Tiananmen Square, which is worth a visit for if you're there in Beijing, and in particular, going to the new galleries about the modern history of China, because the story they tell is about what the Chinese call the century of humiliation, which begins with the British attack on China in 1839, and in their view culminates or ends with the Chinese Communist Party's victory in 1949. And that is a story of humiliation by foreign powers. Thankfully, the British, they seem to be stressing at the moment mainly Japan rather than the UK, but generally the idea that China was weak, because China was weak, it was exploited, and what saves them from weakness, well, it is the rejuvenation led by the Communist Party. There is some truth to that narrative, but it is drummed home in that museum, but also in the curriculums of the Chinese school system, university system, so that a whole generation has been raised to believe that China was humiliated by the outside world, China has stood up, and has what some liberals call, they say they've drunk the wolf's milk of nationalism. So you have a very nationalist Chinese generation coming up, actually now confronting an increasingly nationalist United States, which is potentially a dangerous situation. As well as against that backdrop, and even before Trump came in, you have China and under Xi beginning to talk about itself in a different way. When I first started engaging with Chinese officials, their mantra tended to be that every country should respect each other's sovereignty. They would say, we have absolutely no desire to tell anyone else in the world how to live. We just want the quid pro quo that you don't tell us how to live. You don't tell us how to run our political system. That, to me, has shifted a little bit recently, because in the aftermath of the financial crisis, and as understandable pride grows in the strength of China, there's now talk of a China model of development, and that other countries perhaps could learn from China. And also talk that China may be legitimately challenging this 500-year domination of that the West has had over the world, and leading the world into a more balanced world that is no longer dominated. As actually, this came home to me. I was doing an event at the LSE on this kind of subject, and a Chinese student stuck his hand up and said exactly that. He said, isn't it the case that the world is going to want to learn from China, and that China will lead us away from the domination of the white man? And one of his professors, a Chinese professor, actually sort of leant over to me and said, he is very typical of the new generation. There was a sense that he was speaking for a new view. And it was interesting then going to Tokyo, who have their own reasons to be nervous of the rise of China, and their take, and okay, it's a little biased because they have their own particular view on history, but the Japanese diplomats I spoke to said, you know what, the Chinese are repeating some of the errors that we made in the 1930s. They are challenging American power in the Pacific, and as this Japanese diplomat said, and they will discover that the Americans can be very ruthless, which is one way of looking at it. And he said, and they are also buying into this rhetoric that it's time that an Asian power dislodged the power of the West. Now, maybe that's a legitimate aspiration, but I think one of the ways in which I disagreed with what Kishore had to say was that I don't think there's a huge appetite, even in the rest of Asia, for China to be the dominant power, given the kind of country it is. There certainly isn't in Japan, but even in, you know, I hesitate with a Southeast Asian preceding me, but I don't think that ASEAN is looking for a China-dominated Asia. But perhaps China is beginning to think of that they should be the dominant power in the region. And if they're dominant power in the region, and the region is the center of the world economy, well, they're quite a long way to be towards being the dominant power in the world. And is it simply irrational for us to worry about that? I'm not so sure, because China is a one-party state, it is a country that seeks to control what can be said about the narrative about themselves. And that is clearly the case inside China, but I think it's beginning to be the case outside China, that you will, in a world in which China becomes the dominant power, they will use their power to try to control or at least influence discussion in the West, and that will begin to feel quite uncomfortable for us because we will be lent on in ways that we're only just beginning to notice. And in a way, it's a, you know, they will say, as they've always said, we have no desire to interfere in your internal affairs, how you run yourself. You want to be a democracy, dictatorship, doesn't matter to us. But they do have this concept of the core interests of the Chinese people, which incorporates Taiwan, Tibet, Xinjiang, various other things, in which there is a line that they do not want you to cross. And if you do cross it, you'll feel it. So that, for example, when the Norwegians met the Dalai Lama, they were cut off for a couple of years. Actually, something similar happened to the British. David Cameron met the Dalai Lama, all sort of official high-level ties stopped for a while. But you'll also get it, I think, you're beginning to see it even in universities, because as somebody mentioned, Chinese students are a very, very important source of income. And now, you know, if I talk to academic friends who teach Asian studies, they will find that they're under pressure sometimes from their students now not to say certain things, not to hurt the feelings of the Chinese people. A small example, but I thought a telling one. A friend of mine is a professor at a British university. He's a Czech, actually. He had a big photo of, you'll remember that famous photo of Tiananmen Square, the guy standing in front of the tank. He had it in his office. Administrator said, look, we've had some complaints from the Chinese students about that. Could you take that down? And he said, no, I'm not going to. But the very fact that the request was made was, I think, interesting, and perhaps an example of how things might be beginning to go. And to, you know, these are small incidents, but I suppose I'm asking you to imagine what happens in a world in which the dominant economic power and the dominant political power is no longer the United States, a country that, for all its flaws, which are evident in the current era, is essentially committed to freedom of speech, the rule of law, but is a country that doesn't believe those concepts are so sacrosanct, that will have enormous political and economic leverage if it is the world's largest market, the country that we are depending on for investment, for students, for tourists. It is also a country with increasing military might that it is prepared, if not to deploy, at least to have in the background. As these requests are made, please don't say anything about this. Please don't host so-and-so. You may find a kind of salami slicing where you make this concession that doesn't seem that important, you know, anything for a quiet life, the next one, and then you find that actually some of the freedoms that we've come to take for granted begin to get eroded. So in summary, I don't mean that to be an anti-Chinese diatribe, but I'm trying to balance the view that Kishore gave, which is essentially that, you know, the West has kind of got to get over it, this is inevitable, and it's all really to do with our own problems, and to suggest that there is a problematic element to the rise of China. But there is also, I think, as he correctly said, something difficult about the current American response, which is pretty crude, and which has failed, I think, to rally the Europeans, because Trump is also using protectionist threats against Europe. And I think that may come to be seen as a missed opportunity by the United States, or it may be something that future administrations adjust. Because actually, in its own quiet way, I think I've seen a shift in attitude in Europe as well, for the European Union to refer to China as a potential rival is something very new. If you look at the way that European industry is talking about China, a lot of the complaints that the Americans made are also made by European industrialists. The Chinese are perhaps lucky that the American president that tries to confront them actually tries to confront everybody, and therefore is not capable, as things stand, in creating a united Western front. But I think it's certainly possible that future American administrations may attempt to rally the West, recreate the West, this time not to confront the Soviet Union, but to confront China. And that sounds frightening and unjustified, but it depends how it's done. If it's done in a militaristic way, in a way that says we're going to try to destroy the Chinese economy, I think that is unacceptable, and I don't think Europe would be up for that. But if it is done in a more moderate way that says there are certain standards, international laws on trade, on the law of the sea, that we as a community, not just the West, but also of democratic countries in Asia, want to support, I think that would be legitimate and probably at some point necessary. So I'll leave it there for now. Thank you very much.